Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, another week, another load of property news. House prices will continue to fall, say estate agents. Concern over the number of homeowners taking on super long mortgages. Skipton Building Society causes a stir on Twitter, or X, whatever you want to call it. Nationwide cuts rates again, and the top up-and-coming areas for first-time buyers. Does your area make the cut? Also today, investors go on a gilt-buying spree, Hargreaves announces a basic ready-made pension ahead of new rules, and shoppers grow sick and tired of retail pricing tricks. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, lots of property news this week. Halifax's latest house price figures show a 14 grand drop compared to the recent peak in August 2022. And a 4.7% fall in the year to the end of September, the largest since 2009. Meanwhile, the latest survey by the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors found that buyer demand is declining, fewer homes are coming to market, and house prices will likely continue to fall. Welcome, lads. You know I love a good house price figure, but actually all of these at the moment are pointing in a very similar direction, which makes change. So tell me, Simon, welcome, about the RICS survey, the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors.
The RICS survey is perhaps one of the less scientific of the house price surveys, if you could ever refer to a house price survey as scientific. I believe I may have possibly used the wrong word there, and someone will be sure to correct me. But what it does is it asks estate agents, surveyors, so estate agents who are members of the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, what is going on in the property market near them. And then it takes a reading from that and it gives a balance. And the balance compares the number of people saying, for example, house prices are rising in their area versus the number of people saying that house prices are falling. Whilst you can't read as much into it, for example, as potentially the ONS survey, which is based on sale prices, or the Nationwide or the Halifax data that's based on their own mortgage data, which again can be influenced by Halifax or Nationwide's appetite for lend. You can look at it as a barometer of the housing market. And at the moment, it's pointing towards quite stormy bad weather ahead. So for example, the September net balance of house prices rising or falling was a minus 69%. That's in favour of house prices falling. The readings that we are getting from the RICS survey on house prices, buyer demand, what they think is going to happen to house prices in the future, are all broadly level with 2009. They're basically the worst readings that we've seen since 2009. And 2009 was not a particularly pretty time for the housing market. It was when house prices were falling quite strongly after the financial crisis.
Lee, how does this all fit in? What's going to happen next?
Well, quickly on this RICS one, this is a kind of monthly survey that I've always kind of kept an eye on over the years, because it's an interesting one to go and dive in and read viewpoints from a lot of different estate agents from all different regions of the country. And you get a real flavour of what's going on in certain regions and what's going on in certain towns and cities and that kind of thing. So it's always a good one, a good snapshot, a good temperature of what's going on. And actually in this one, I thought the really interesting part was the falls, the dropping kind of confidence in the West Midlands and the South East. Net balance of 94% and 91% seeing house price falls, as opposed to them staying the same or rising. That's a meaty old number. I think what's going on in the market at the moment, and what was kind of alluded to in this, is that a lot of people, potential buyers, movers, are kind of potentially, we always have a bit of a seasonal lull now anyway, we come to now to the end of the year. I think what the hinting is here from the experts is that there's going to be a bit of a lull all the way up to the next general election. Because we've had lots of measures, especially from the Labour Party in its recent conference about house building and, you know, all of the kind of elements that might be there to get people onto the property ladder and that kind of thing. And there's always a lot of government meddling, isn't there, in the property market, like we said in the past. So I think if you're, there's still, the thing is, I still think that people are buying homes. I don't think there's all of a sudden people off stop buying homes. They're hoping for another stamp duty holiday, for example, or some sort of package or measure that's going to kind of change what's going on at the moment. I think people still want to buy homes. People still want to sell. But it's an interesting snapshot of what's going on. And I think that with that on top of the Halifax index, which basically, again, as Simon just said, worst reading since 2009, house prices are dropping. I think there's a lot of would-be buyers out there at the moment that are kind of tempted to hold fire. You know, can they fall any lower? I think that, again, to be smart and to be ahead of the market, if you are someone in the sort of realms of wanting to buy somewhere, is just having all of the kind of Right Move, Zoopla, house price alert set up for the kind of property that you're looking for. And also just keeping a gauge on what's going on locally to you or where you want to buy. You know, what are you seeing? Are you seeing lots of properties being discounted, for example? There's been quite a lot of studies in the last few weeks suggesting that people are putting their homes up for sale and overpricing them. And that can be quite, you know, detrimental thing to do in the long run, because you might end up with far less than what you were expected to get for your property. So it's all in a bit of a kind of limbo at the moment. I think it has been in limbo for a bit of time. And I just get this general impression, and I've had this conversation with a few friends, you know, talking about, I'm just going to stay put, you know, I'm going to wait another 6 to 9 months and see what goes on. It's very difficult, though, in my opinion, to time the market. I think if you want to buy a home and you need to buy a home, my viewpoint's always been just go for it. And there's always been this kind of fable, there's going to be a house price crash. Now, can we say that this is a house price crash? I mean, it's been a gentle kind of reduction in prices in which property prices completely rocketed, as we mentioned before, in the pandemic. And it's kind of gently kind of nudging down. And my viewpoint is, if you want to buy a home, buy a home. How much can they go? It's hard to tell. You know, at the moment, it feels like they are falling off gradually. When they bottom out is anyone's guess.
That's it, Lee. That just a quick one. Fine if you're already in a home and you don't have to move and you can wait, but you know, if you're a first time buyer, if you're renting at the moment, for example, I mean, what's happening with the rental market? It's gone bananas. So I think you told me a story about someone whose rent went up, was it 50%?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's gone absolutely crackers. And that's a whole different podcast to be said about the rental market and renters and landlords and the pressures that both are facing, you know, both sides of the coin. You know, landlords are facing up to higher mortgage costs and higher costs in general, and that's being fed through to renters. And, you know, lots of landlords are deciding to exit, and that's putting a lot of demand pressure on, you know, good quality housing stock for renters. And we're seeing, as a result, rents are going absolutely through the roof. I was watching BBC Panorama about it the other day, about the housing market and the rental market, and lots of people are, if you're already renting, having to digest absolutely huge potential extra rent each month, but landlords also are facing up to, you know, higher rates. And we've seen lots of tax cuts, you know, tax benefits for being a landlord cut in recent years. I think a lot of landlords are just fed up and thinking, you know, do I want to do this anymore? And all of this is just creating a perfect storm. And that's it. And if you're renting, I mean, as we've spoken about before, and we know, it is hard to save for that deposit. And it can be quite frightening jumping from renter to buyer and wanting to make sure that you don't end up feeling like you're overpaying for something. It's a huge decision. It's a huge amount of debt to take on as a first-time buyer. And also movers, you know, there's probably a lot of movers out there at the moment thinking about potentially downsizing. It's all in a bit of a muddle at the moment. I think we've just come off this absolute fireworks of house price rises. And there's a lot of kind of, let's stay put for now. What are we going to do next type mentality? And I totally understand it.
Simon, what do you do? Give us some tips for if you're a buyer or you're a seller.
Well, this matters the most if you are a buyer or a seller. If you're somebody who is not planning on buying a home anytime soon, or moving home, whether you're a first-time buyer or a home mover, or you're not planning on selling your home anytime soon, then it doesn't really matter to you. You can just sit there and not worry about it. You don't have to sell your home right now, so it doesn't really matter whether it's worth more now than it was a year ago or worth less now than it was a year ago. What matters is what happens when you come to sell and you want to move home. And then what really matters then is not how much your house is worth, it's how much the house that you want to move to is going to cost you, and whether you can sell your home for enough money to facilitate that move. And ideally speaking, what you want to happen, unless you are the very, very few people right at the top of a chain who are selling up, or a buy-to-let landlord selling up, what you ideally want to happen if you're a home mover is for house prices not to have moved at all. Because if your house has gone up by 20% in value in the time that you've owned it, the house that you want to buy has probably gone up by 20% in value. And chances are most people normally move to a bigger, more expensive house. And the way mathematics works is that you're going to end up paying more money and having to borrow more money on a mortgage and having to raise more money in extra deposit in order to facilitate the move. So ideal scenario is houses don't get any more expensive and yours just sits there, not rising in value, not falling in value. But if you are going to buy or sell now, then to go back to something Lee said, you need to really get to know your market, get to know the market where you are. So for example, and I would give this tip to both buyers and sellers, look at Rightmove, but don't just look at Rightmove and look at the prices and go, oh, right, okay, yeah, well, I reckon, you know, that house there is that much. And my house is definitely better than that house because, you know, let's face it, everybody's got the best house, the better house than somebody else. You know, it's always slightly better than the one that's comparable. So you ask a little bit more for it. Look at what's happening to those prices. Are prices being reduced in your area? When you look down the list of properties, flip it from highest price to newest listed and look down those newest listings and ask yourself, am I seeing the word reduced repeatedly? Rightmove will tell you, for example, whether a house has been reduced, and I believe Zoopla does too. There are also a couple of Chrome browser extension things that you can get that will help you identify how much prices have come down by. So there's one called Property Log, there's one called Property Tracker. And then when you go to Rightmove on your Chrome browser, you'll be able to see not only that the price has come down, but you'll be able to see by how much. So I'm scrolling down properties for sale in my postcode at the moment. And the first one I can find that's had its price reduced, that's had £25,000 taken off the price. So that's down 4.3%. I can then find one that's had 13.5% taken off the price. This is an expensive property, started at 1127450, very specific price. It's now down to 975. So that's 13.5%, 150 grand chopped off the price of that one. I've got another one that's on sale at the moment at 860,000. That came onto the market in June at 950. So that's had £90,000 taken off the price, 9.5%, and so on and so on. Next one's got 7% off. Next one's got 7.7% off. Next one's got 4.1% off. Next one's got 2.7% off. Next one's got 12.2% off. You get the picture here, right? You can see how much this house has been discounted. Now, if somebody's heavily discounted a property, then it looks like they're probably pretty keen to sell. You get different motivations from people who are selling. How much do they want to sell? Is it a bit of a hit and hope? And they're just going to put it on for a high price and they're going to sit there until somebody pays it. And in that instance, the house could sit there for a long time without the house price changing. Or do they really need to sell? In which case, they're probably going to have priced it a bit lower anyway, and then they might cut the price. Or do they need to sell because they found somewhere that they want to buy? And this is something you need to find out when you go to look at properties. You need to ask the estate agent, what's the position of the seller? Why are they selling? I mean, the estate agent will tell you they want to sell the house. Is it a probate sale? Is it a home mover? Is it a downsizer? Is it a landlord? Have they found somewhere that they want to buy is the key question if they're a home mover. Because if they've found somewhere they want to buy and they've made an offer and it's been accepted, they need to get their house under offer so that they can buy the house that they want to buy. They are at that point a highly motivated seller. So you can use this to your advantage. And when you look at those prices and those price reductions, those are just the price reductions on the asking price. Now, at the moment, houses are going for below the asking price. So it's then up to you to negotiate. Nobody likes negotiating in Britain. Well, very few people like negotiating in Britain. But, you know, you've got to do it. And ultimately, there's a saying that you make your money when you buy, not when you sell. So don't be ashamed to ask for money off. And, you know, the worst that happens is the seller comes back and says no. And in fact, actually, if you've ever sold a property in a really, really slow market where it's really difficult to just get an offer, then actually you welcome people giving you offers, even if they are lower, because at least you know that you're getting offers in and you can try to gauge, well, where does the interest lie? And that then moves me on to the point where if you're a seller, you need to equally be looking at this stuff. It's no use just sticking your head in the sand and going, well, do you know what? If we'd have sold a year ago, we'd have got this. So should we just try and get that now? Because that's probably not going to get your house sold unless you've got an absolute banger of a trophy property or something that people really, really, really want. And there are some of those around. There are some of those around that are still going for more than they would have gone for, but they are few and far between. Then you're going to have to accept that you're going to have to accept a lower price now than you would have done a year ago. And you need to know what's going on in your market. What are your competitors doing? Your competitors are all the other people near you selling any kind of comparable home to you. And it's not just exactly the same, because people will often, there's some flexibility in buyers. They'll go, okay, well, I'd really like that one, but you know what? That one's 50 grand cheaper. I'm going to go for that one and I will compromise. And compromise is the key. And then you need to think about how motivated you are as a seller. Are you just doing it because you're quite fancy moving? You haven't found anywhere to buy. You're not really actively looking that much. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't really matter. Or do you really need to sell? Do you really need to move? Have you found something that you want to buy? And then or do you want to get yourself in a position where you can make offers on places right now because you think it's better to be buying when other people don't want to buy, and you're therefore willing to accept a lower sale price in order to put yourself in that good position of being able to say, yep, my house is under offer and here's my offer on that house and I want to move. So you've got to get into it in that way if you really want to buy or sell it.
Some very, very good tips. Lee, let's just do a quick couple of stories, a bit of a roundup. So I was quite interested to see a bit of a spat going on X or Twitter or whatever about Skipton's latest offering. Who knew it could be so controversial? I think someone called it a loan shark. And Nationwide cutting rates again. Let's go with Skipton first, though. What's got all the controversy, Lee?
Loan sharks, a bit of a stretch. I must confess, though, this year, I do feel like Skipton has gone on a bit of a kind of like PR.
Right.
And I feel like they've kind of managing to get headlines by doing things like launching headline grabbing rates.
See, this says the difference between us, Lee, right? I'd written here, Skipton are quite innovative in this space, to which you write, they've been on a PR spree.
Well, I think it's just one of those things where you see...
You're cynic.
New mortgage rate at 3.35%, and you're kind of going, oh, wow, that's quite a lot lower than the market. Bearing in mind, we were just coming off the back of averages of like 6%. And you're thinking, okay, what's the catch here? What's going on? You know, straight away, the cynic in me is like, that ain't going to be 3.35%. There's got to be some huge catch. So this is for people with a 40% equity in their homes, 6%, 60% LTV. And 3.35% on paper sounds great until you get to the T's and C's. It comes with a massive 5% fee, which is quite an unusual chunky fee to come with a mortgage, which shows why when you're comparing mortgages, you should always factor in the rate alongside the fee. Now, a fee typically is around about £1,000, 995. Sometimes they're a little bit higher than that, sometimes a little bit less than that. And in the good old days, quite often there wasn't a fee. But you need to factor that in whenever you are looking at a new mortgage and what you're going to pay. So that's why there was so much controversy on Twitter, because, you know, it's kind of people saying you take out mortgage debt at 200 grand and then you're going to bung 10 grand on it, which, you know, is 10 grand fee. It then sounds absolutely astronomical. Mark Harris, who's a mortgage broker, said a 3.35% 2-year fix with a 5% fee should be regarded as a 5.85% deal, with the fee spread over the 2 years when comparing with other products. So that's right. The way to view it. So yeah, I don't know why the Skipton have decided to do this, but I do know, because it's become a talking.
We're talking about
it's
it exactly.
exactly that. You know, and earlier in the year when they did the 100% equity mortgage, remember that all kicked off. Basically, no deposit mortgages. I mean, that kicked off big style.
We'll talk about annoying pricing later, but Simon?
One thing it does help with is it potentially helps with getting people through the affordability checks that you have to do. Mm-hmm. So, for example, affordability is based on how much you've got going out on your mortgage versus all your other outgoings added up as well, plus your incomings. And one of the problems that people are finding now, and I've had this mentioned to me a number of times by first-time buyers recently, is that they're now discovering that the deposit has stopped being the problem. It's the mortgage that's now the problem, and the monthly payments on it, and they're not able to pass those the affordability checks on the monthly payments for the mortgage size that they need, whereas previously they could pass those affordability checks, which is galling for anybody who would actually be paying less on their mortgage than they would be in rent, which is quite often the case for the people who were telling me these things. But that is how these affordability checks work. Now, if Skipton can drag down that mortgage rate, it's going to make those monthly payments lower. It's going to be easier for people to get through the affordability checks. And then you take the fee and you potentially add it to the loan. And whilst that means that if you pay that fee back over 35 years, for example, I've used the word number 35 for a reason, then you will, you know, divide it up. You will also pay much, much more because you're paying interest on it over 35 years, but it will mean that you are more likely to pass those affordability checks.
And why did you mention 35, Simon?
I don't know, it's just like a number came to my head. Because the Bank of England has once more aroused itself from its slumbers in the cave where it dozes off every so often and gone, there's an awful lot of 35-year mortgages going on. We don't like this. We're worried about this.
Why? What's wrong with a 35-year mortgage term, Simon?
Well, I mean, it costs people quite a lot more money over 35 years to borrow rather than 25 years. And it means that more people are going to end up in retirement still with a mortgage. And broadly speaking, it's better if you pay off the debt in over a shorter period of time. There's also a scenario whereby what people often do is they take a mortgage and then they remortgage. And then they, instead of sticking with the 30 or 33 that they've got themselves down to, they go back to 35 because it makes the monthly payments lower, or they move home and they go, well, you know, we've got it down to 28 years now. We stick it back to 35, we'll have a bit more money in our pocket each month and we'll be able to pass those affordability checks I was just talking about.
Mm.
And so they go back to 35. And so you end up with this scenario where people aren't just taking out 35-year mortgages at the start. They're taking out 35-year mortgages 2 or 5 years down the line, and then another couple of times. I don't think that's happening quite so much at the moment. And there are limits on how much lenders can do this in terms of lending into retirement. But yes, the Bank of England is concerned about the number of 35-year mortgages going on. I mean, they have been going on for quite some time now. This is not something that has suddenly emerged. We have been talking about this a little bit on things like this podcast, on This Is Money. Other financial websites have also mentioned these long mortgage terms, for example. And in fact, some people are taking 40-year mortgage terms. Actually, to put that in perspective, you don't have to go back very long for the standard mortgage term to be 25 years. And if you're taking a 40-year mortgage term, you're knocking on the door of double, twice as long. Mm. You know, that is quite a big difference.
Lee?
Yeah, I was just going to say, this Bank of England suggesting that 4% of mortgages, new lending in the first quarter of 2021 were for 35 years, and it's now 12%. So it's quite a leap in a couple of years. But equally, I can understand why people are doing it. You know, it will cost you more in the long run, but it brings your monthly payments down in the short term. And that's kind of what people are doing. And I think when we think about 25-year mortgage terms as being the norm, you know, that was in a kind of time when house prices just weren't as high as what they are now. So you can kind of understand why people are doing it. And when I took my mortgage out in 2016, I actually went in between. We had a 30-year mortgage term. And once 5 years was up, so we had 25 years left, I just took 5 years off the mortgage. So when I remortgaged, I did it on a 20-year term. So it's not like you are completely wedded to it, but it just depends on your circumstances and what happens with the equity in your property and all of those kind of things, which at the moment, you know, where we are seeing house prices fall off a bit, and there was such a spurt of buying at the tail end of 2021 and throughout 2022, lots of people coming for back of 2 year fixed mortgages might not be in that position where they're seeing the equity in their home having risen, which is the sort of scenario that we have seen since the financial crisis, really. And quickly, just while we're on the mortgage front, Nationwide has launched two quite attractive Best Buy mortgage deals. So it's got a 5 year fix at 4.74% now, and a 3 year fix for 4.99%. That's for remortgaging people moving, so it's not for like first time buyers, but it's still an interesting kind of move. It's for people with a 40% deposit against a 60% LTV, and that comes with a 999 fee. Just to put some context after talking about the Skipton one. But Nationwide, such a major lender, looks like little nudges and steps in the right direction after a couple of weeks of mortgage fallbacks from other major lenders. Whether it goes much further than that, it remains to be seen. A lot of experts saying this is probably where they think it's going to kind of settle for the kind of medium term. But we'll keep an eye out and see if rates continue to fall.
Meanwhile, one final story on property. Average first-time buyer property prices have surged, almost doubled in the last decade, almost 150,000 to 290,000. So you've been taking a look at the up-and-coming first-time buyer locations, according to Halifax. What it looks like is if you've got a load of places in the middle and you've just squished them out to the outer reaches of every part of the UK, that's about where first-time buyers can go. Is that right? What do we make of this? There's some interesting places here, I have to say. Middlesbrough, Eastbourne. That was a bit of a surprise for me. I wouldn't have thought that would be in there. Neath, Portalbert, Falkirk. Where else? Simon?
Hull. If you want to buy a first-time buyer, move to Hull.
There's some odd ones in there. I thought I'd leave Hull to you.
It's 23% cheaper compared to the regional average for a first-time buyer. Middlesbrough, 11% cheaper. Neath, Portalbert, 20% cheaper. Derry, City and Strabane, 8% cheaper. Falkirk, 12% cheaper. Blackburn with Darwin, 21% cheaper. Aberdeen, 8% cheaper. Telford and Wrekin, 10% cheaper. Ipswich, 25% cheaper. And Eastbourne, 29% cheaper. You're right. It's everything being pushed out from the centre and to places that are a bit further away. But this is a genuine thing that's going on. It's going on with renters as well. You're seeing less people renting in London, people being pushed out. The people in London are being pushed out to the outer areas. It's the same with buyers, and they're being pushed further out to the outer areas. And some people are just going, leave, no point bothering in London, and going somewhere else instead. And ultimately, what this is a market correcting itself. It's a market going, that's too expensive, I'm not buying that, I'm going to buy the thing that's cheaper, I'm going to go to the place that's cheaper, take some of the demand out of the expensive place, take some of that demand to the less expensive place, and rebalances things slightly, and then ultimately the effect will go far enough that things start to move again. So if you were to just leave the housing market alone, which is not a particularly popular policy amongst Britain's politicians, if you were to just leave the housing market alone, you would see this kind of thing all the time, and probably to a greater degree. But this is a market that is heavily, heavily intervened with, sort of correcting itself a little bit.
Lee, where tickles your fancy on the list there?
I'd love to see an influx of first-time buyers to Eastbourne, which of course is traditionally seen as a kind of retirement.
I've actually heard that Eastbourne is the new, it's the new Dalston. Forget Margate. Margate's done. It's all about Eastbourne now.
Oh, well, there we go. I mean, my wife went to university in Eastbourne and always tells me how lovely it was there. So, potentially. I think some of this is as you say, it's just people looking for a kind of alternative potentially. And look, there's no reason to not potentially move to some of these places. You know, if you've got to look at things and think about things like the local labour market and what it is that you do for a living is probably the number one thing, and how close you are to family and friends and all that kind of stuff. But you know, Ipswich, for example, I've been to Ipswich a couple of times, is a perfectly nice place, and I think it probably gets skewed by other Suffolk areas, you know, are very expensive. Your Aldboroughs, your South Wolds on the coast, you know, not a million miles away from Ipswich. And I think there's lots of this kind of regional disparities going on. And I think a lot of first-time buyers probably are tempted to sort of look at alternatives that they might not have thought about before. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. And somewhere like Hull, I mean, Hull's had a huge amount of investment. It was the City of Culture in 2017. You know, I'm sure it's a perfectly lovely place to live. You know, Middlesbrough's had a lot of investment. You know, these places should be kind of brought up into a place where people want to go move and get a cheaper house in. Like, it makes complete sense to me. I kind of totally understand it. I mean,
I say this as someone who doesn't have kids, right? But I do think, and it's getting later and later, sort of in your early 30s, you want to be near your family. Like, you know, if we were buying houses in our early 20s, yeah, go live in Hull if your family are in, I don't know, Bristol. But actually, this is, you know, this is impacting on people's life decisions. Do you know what I mean? The rising house prices, etc. There's so many other considerations now.
Yeah, but I guess the thing is, what the other flip side to this, or the way this research is probably thinking, is more like, you know, if you're Yorkshire based, you know, look at Hull rather than look at, you know,
Eastbourne.
Yeah, no, you know, like the kind of more expensive areas of Yorkshire and those surrounding regions. I don't think they're suggesting move from the southwest up to Hull. I don't think that's kind of what the research is. I think you've got to think of it from a kind of radius point of view, you know, like a 1 to 2 hour radius of potentially, you know, if you're moving from Bristol to Aberdeen,
fair, I mean, point, Lee.
That's like moving from Bristol to, you know, the south of France. I mean, it's like,
that'd be nice.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think that's what this research is suggesting. I think it's more kind of like what's available in the local area, because, you know, lots of these places do have hot pockets of places that are expensive, and it's kind of like what's an alternative. And that's the way I viewed this piece of research anyway. The one thing I must take complete umbrage to, though, is the up and coming term. I mean, up and coming, everywhere's up and come at some point now, isn't it? I mean, you can't, I don't know.
Does it have a Waitrose? Does it sell sourdough bread?
No.
Loads of cafes.
If it does that, if it's done that,
have all the banks been turned into wine bars?
It's done. You can't move there.
It's come.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's finished. You can't move there. No.
Got it. So no sourdough. That's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. DIY investors went on a gilt buying spree in September, shunning the stock market and savings accounts. The UK government bonds were paying as little as 0.125% last month. But deep-pocketed investors piled an average of 129,000 into just 5 short-dated UK bonds. As a result, AJ Bell, that did the research, said that UK bonds with low yields made up 5 of the 10 most popular investments bought by DIY investors in that month. Simon Wolf, there's a lot to dig into here. Why would you buy bonds below par? But first, what are gilts? What are short-dated bonds? What does it all mean?
Well, they're an up-and-coming area. Gilts
no
are,
sourdough in these, right?
No sourdough. Mm-mm. No sourdough or Waitrose.
No Waitrose.
Short-dated gilts. Well, actually, right, I imagine the people who are buying these short-dated gilts probably do quite a lot of shopping in Waitrose and eat quite a lot of sourdough. What's happening is gilts are UK government bonds. This, the government issues bonds and it says to investors, we will pay you X percent every year until the end of the bond's lifetime, and then we'll give you all of your money back. So, for example, 5-year bond, they might say to investors right now, we will give you 4.5% for the next 5 years, and then in 5 years' time, you will get all of your money back. And that's what's known as par. So par value, face value, say the bond is £100. You buy that bond for £100 now, you pick up £5 in interest, which is known as the coupon, every single year. And then in 5 years' time, you get your £100 back. That's if you buy a bond at issue and you hold it to maturity, then you will know exactly what you're going to get. As long as the British government and the British taxpayer, in fact, us, as long as we don't go bust, you get your money back. Now, you can also buy bonds secondhand. They're traded on the open market. And the price of that bond on the open market will depend on how much demand there is for the interest or the yield that it pays. So, for example, if you can get 5% on a savings account, then one of these bonds that was issued some time ago and only pays 0.125% interest because interest rates were so low not so long ago, doesn't look particularly attractive from a price point of view, because you could instead get a brand new bond that will pay you 4.5%. So that will trade below par value. What we've had in the past is when interest rates were very low, older bonds that had higher interest rates, but that were issued when interest rates were higher, were trading above par value. And so you get this thing called the yield to maturity, which is if you bought that bond now and you held it until the date of maturity and you get all of your money back, what is the yield that you will get? So, for example, if you were going to buy a bond that pays, you know, 0.125% and it's currently trading, instead of at £100, it's trading at £96, then you'll measure what's the return you get if you hold it until the end date. You pick up your 0.125% interest, which is going to be frankly peanuts, but you also get the uplift back from buying it at £96 to £100. The key thing is, for what's going on at the moment, is that that uplift in the gilt's price is capital gains tax free. So what a number of deep pocketed investors, not lots of them, but you know, there has been a rush to do this. And I first started hearing about this over summer, actually, and it came from people who worked, you know, in the kind of financial investment kind of wealth industry, who said, yeah, actually, I'm sticking my money in short dated gilts, because I'm going to get a return and it's going to be tax-free. And then when you compare it to the return that I would have to get on a savings account to match that, I'd need to be getting 9% on a savings account to match that. And I can't get 9% on the savings account. Whereas if I buy this gilt that matures, for example, the most popular on an AJ Bell's list, matures on the 31st of January, 2024, so not very far away, then I can make this big yield to maturity. And we actually, interestingly, wrote a story about this last week. Helen Crane, our reporter, looked into this, and she had a look at some of these bonds and what they were trading at and what the yield to maturity would be, and then compared it to the tax rates. And you have to bear in mind, you know, when you're comparing it to savings accounts, a savings account over £1,000, if you're a basic rate taxpayer, it's taxed at 20%. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, it's taxed at 40%. That's over £500 worth of interest a year. And if you're an additional rate taxpayer, which I suspect quite a lot of the people putting £129,000 on average into each of these bonds might be, then you don't get any personal savings allowance at all. So when we looked at this at the end of September, the UK gilt that matured on the 31st of January next year pays 0.13%. It was priced at £98.44. So you could buy £100 for £98.44. Yield to maturity was 4.93%. Doesn't look that great when you can pretty much get that on a money market fund, or if you're an individual and easy access savings account, but you're going to pay tax on that. Compare it to a basic rate taxpayer who's passed their personal savings allowance, they'd need to get 6.16% to match that. They could do that on a 1-year bond. Compare that to a 40% taxpayer, though, they'd need to get 8.17%. Compare that to an additional rate, 45% taxpayer, they would need to get 8.9%. So this is why people are doing this. There's a tax quirk in there that is pretty good. And, you know, there are, despite the number of people struggling in this country, quite a few people out there with quite a lot of money who have the ability to do this. And it's a bit of a thing, basically, at the moment.
A bit of a thing, but not for probably ordinary folk.
For most people, there's no point doing it.
Yeah. I'm just laughing because I was doing a podcast the other day and they said, stick to one stat, one figure. That's really all people can manage. I don't know how many you just said there, Simon. I'm all over the place with that. But very, very interesting nonetheless. Let's talk instead about Hargreaves Lansdown. They're launching a basic no-frills pension for those who want to, an easy way to invest for retirement, but they aren't quite sure how to get started. Now, they're the first SIPP provider to give details of this basic pension. After regulators said that they had to offer, not just Hargreaves, all of these providers, customers a default option by the start of December. Before we get more into that, Lee, firstly, what's a SIPP? Who do they most benefit?
So it's a self-invested personal pension. And the long and short of it is, if you're not saving into a workplace pension, really, you're going to want to have a SIPP. So really,
self-employed
people, essentially the majority of which a SIPP would be a beneficial thing to have. The thing is with SIPPs and getting self-employed people engaged with opening a SIPP and saving for their retirement can be quite a difficult thing. I've had numerous conversations with friends in recent months who are self-employed, and trying to get them to open a SIPP is just almost like falls on deaf ears. They just don't understand.
Why?
I don't know. It just seems to be a very difficult. I think pensions in general, anyway, look, let's face it, it's a very difficult thing to get people engaged with, especially in their 20s and 30s. You know, the thought of retirement just feels so far away. You know, there's lots of other sort of life milestones that I think people try and sort of do first. And I think for that reason, you know, pensions slip down. And that's why auto-enrollment has been a very good thing, I think, because lots of people have now got more engaged with their pension and looking at what their retirement is going to entail. But then it's very difficult. And part of that is because often your workplace will match what you're putting in. And in some cases, depending on how long you've worked at a certain place, they might even add extra in. And it's a great way to save. It's almost like having a salary bump that you can't sort of access until you're much later on in life, but you will be grateful of it, that you've saved properly into it. Now, trying to convince people to, you know, a SIPP is a very similar thing. You know, you don't get the contributions from an employer, of course, but you still get the tax benefits of having a pension. So it's a very beneficial way to save. And as you say, there's all of these major providers now having to come out with a kind of a basic version of this, and a basic sort of default version. It's very sort of simple to get people sort of opening these and doing it. And this Hargreaves one, we've finally got the details of, and it's going to have a de-risk phase. So the last 8 year run up to retirement, it's going to start making it kind of put it into less risky funds, for example. And basically, it comes with a 0.75% annual fee.
Isn't that quite highly?
It is. When you the direct comparison that I asked Tanya Jeffries, our investment and pensions editor, to compare this with is Vanguard, because Vanguard came out with a SIPP. I think it was last year, and I'm starting to lose track of time. Like, time is just kind of like disappearing on me. Was it last year? Was it about 18 months ago?
I was going to say, feels earlier than that, but I don't know either.
The Vanguard sort of mentality and philosophy is sort of very low charge. So the comparison of this is that Vanguard SIPP has a 0.15 charge, capped at £375, but fund fees are charged on top of that, starting at 0.06% for a FTSE all share tracker, most basic thing you can put in there. So you will pay extra on top of that 0.15% fee. But look, I think that this is a really good thing. I think that when we get more details of this, and hopefully there'll be a bit of a battle between what the fees are that are being charged, hopefully it'll bring it more into the forefront of self-employed minds, where they're seeing big companies sort of pushing these a little bit harder, and people might actually take the time one dull, wet weekend to say, know what, I should actually really look into this SIPP thing and sort it out, you know. And there's lots of, you know, so many millions of people are self-employed in this country, you know, and I don't know what the figures are, but I would suspect there's quite a lot of that don't have a SIPP and hear the word SIPP and just go, what on earth is that? It just sounds dull, doesn't it? A SIPP.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, it's not engaging enough, I think, for, you know, large chunks of the self-employed. And I, you know, I'd like to think there's people who listen to this and go and have a look at what a SIPP can do for them. That they're magic, you know, just like saving for a pension. You know, you want to take control of your retirement, and I think that a SIPP as a self-employed person is a very important thing to have.
Couldn't agree more. As a self-employed person. Simon, is there any way, or is it just way too complicated to get a similar sort of auto-enrollment style. A portion of your contractor or self-employed wage goes towards a default pension. Would that ever work?
I'm calling it now. 11:47, 13th yeah. of October, 2023. Yeah. This is the point where Lee Boyce first made his play for SIPs to be renamed Help to Retire. Coming soon to a budget near you. Help to Retire. That's what we need to get Britain back on its feet. Get rid of that boring SIP term.
Why not?
Or the retirement powerhouse or something like that. Maybe that would be strong enough. Look, you know, it's really difficult if you're self-employed because every single penny counts and you've got tax bills you've got to put your money aside for, you've got lean periods you've got to put your money aside for, you don't have the support that you have from having that money coming in every single month as an employee. Even if you end up in the red every month and then you get your pay packet and you go back into the black, at least you know you're getting that money every single month. It's very, very difficult for self-employed people because there may be months when there's a real lean period and they just don't get their money, or they don't get their, you know, their bills paid, all those kinds of things. And so, you know, it can be difficult to regularly put that money into a pension, but you've got to try and do it or commit to doing a lump sum each year. Perhaps a lot of self-employed people I know will put money into their account for their tax bill and they'll put in more than they need. They'll add a buffer in there, especially with things like when you're charging VAT, they'll add a buffer in there because you can get caught out on that stuff quite easily. So if you are in the habit of doing that and you end up at the end of the year, then, you know, take some of that up money, take some of that buffer, shove it in that pension, you know, and keep saving for your retirement, because it is a problem, you know, that we've very much solved, not completely, but we've done a lot to move towards sorting out employed people thanks to auto enrollment. We haven't done anything similar for self-employed.
Indeed. Right, finally, I did say that we would moan a little bit more about dodgy pricing, shrinkflation, bogus loyalty card savings, variable prices. We're fed up with a lot of them, Lee. Underhand tactics by supermarkets, manufacturers, pubs and others are thwarting our budgeting efforts. I'm not sure we actually need research to tell us this, but we have it nonetheless from Barclaycard that tells us that a fair proportion of us are pretty sick and tired of all this. I know that the pair of you from podcasts many years past moan about loyalty cards, but Lee, to me, it seems nowadays that you cannot work out what's good. You're not getting fair prices if you just happen to go in a shop. The only way to actually get a reasonable price, not a discounted one, just a normal price, is to have a loyalty card now for some supermarkets. It's gone bananas, hasn't it?
Oh, I like what you did there, Georgie. Very good. Look, there's three things that are just winding me up about shops in general at the moment. Now,
just three.
Just the three. Now, number one is the shrinkflation situation. So 2 in 3 shoppers say that shrinkflation, when an item's weight falls but the price doesn't, has become so common that shops should put warning labels on products that become smaller and not cheaper. I quite like that, but it would make supermarket shopping an absolute kind of like minefield of little signs saying this. I like it though. Big red arrow. This is now 10 grams smaller, but the same price. I like it. I think there should be a warning. Now, the second thing is the loyalty card element. I mean, honestly, if you pop into a Sainsbury's or Tesco now and you've, for whatever reason, not got your Nectar card or your club
walk out.
I just walk out, honestly. Yeah. So I have a little Tesco local here. So full disclosure, we're Aldi shoppers. You might not be surprised to hear that. I love an Aldi, but the local Aldi got demolished about 6 months ago, and they're rebuilding it. I've been going past it on the train, and it looks exactly the same size and the same frame structure. I'm not too sure what's been going on. So for that reason, we've had to move supermarket, and I finally bitten the bullet. and now I've got an online delivery pass. For the first time ever, we're actually grown adults. We've actually got food in the house because we're getting a weekly shop. We pay 40 quid for this pass, right? That lasts a year, and you can get deliveries on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It's been working out absolutely fine. But there are those little occasions where you might forget something or might not have, you know, what you need. So I'll go to the little local Tesco up the road. And I quite often just don't. I have a club card on my phone, but I sometimes forget to take the phone or phone's out of battery or whatever. And then I'm in there and I'm looking like, I'm not going to buy that. I'm not going to buy that if it's on a club card price because I don't have the club card with me and I'm not paying more because I don't have a club card. And I think it's absolutely disgraceful. Actually, I'm so fed up of it. Honestly, once this Audi gets built, it's such a simple experience that I've just much prefer it. Go in. There's no, I don't feel that there's any gimmicks. The price is the price. And I just personally, I prefer that. But maybe you're someone that quite likes collecting all the points and all that kind of stuff. But for me, I just don't enjoy it.
I don't like collecting the points, Lee. But I think it's got to a stage. I do remember it was a few years ago and I got my wallet out. I've now moved with the times because a few of my loyalty cards are actually on my phone now. Well done, me. But I got my wallet out and they clattered all the loyalty cards I had, right? And yes, in the day, there used to be a sort of loyalty principle that the points, you know, and Boots were very good. I like them. But now it feels like, Simon, if you don't have, like Lee said, if you don't have a Tesco card, well, one, there's just no point. But I also feel like I said earlier, you're not actually getting a discount. You're just paying what you should be paying, a reasonable price, whereas they just hike it up for everyone who's forgotten their cards. So I don't know how, if you want to go shopping in Tesco, you could do it without a card.
I think if you were going to do your weekly shop, then I think that's a definite issue with something like Tesco, with Sainsbury's, with Nectar. I think if you're just going into the shop, then I think maybe sometimes this backfires. I've not bought things because I don't have that specific retailer's loyalty card. And I've thought, well, I was going to buy that, but I'm not paying that much when I could have it for that much if I had the card. I can't get the card right now because I'm in the shop. I'm not going to go sign up to their membership system right now. So I just won't buy that thing. And so I do wonder whether they're actually costing themselves some sales there. Definitely an issue if you've got a weekly shop. I'm not a fan of this way the Nectar prices, club card prices thing has been going. The one thing I would say is, you know, if you are of the sort of theory, mindset, whatever you want to call it, that there's no point fighting the tide of this whilst costing yourself money, then you can get the cards. You don't have to have them all in your pocket. Most of them you can scan now. Take a screenshot of it. Have it on your phone and then you can just swipe through and easily find it and scan that and, you know, keep them on their toes. Just occasionally buy something totally random that you don't want and then it messes with their data.
That's right. Well, let's finish off point two because, you know, the information and data that it's not just supermarkets, but everyone that seems to be holding on us is just growing and growing. And there's little things like even I hate this absolute push for putting train tickets on my phone, for example, or just like a paper ticket. Does that make me old fashioned? I don't know. I just prefer having a paper ticket. It's just what I prefer. Like, why are we phasing all these things out all of the time? And the third thing, I promised you three things. I've finished on point two.
It almost feels, and
I think shoppers are in this kind of boat where they feel like it's constantly like Black Friday. So what I mean by that is the product gets marked down on one of these loyalty schemes, but was already potentially at that point somewhere else in the year, or it's been like the price has been taken up only to then come down to make it look better than it is. And there's been a lot of research done by Which about this kind of way that they're framing this, which I think is really interesting. Now, the third thing that's been getting on my real nerves lately, George, and this is shops in general, is the move to self-checkouts.
My dad hates that.
Mad. Now, look, 10 items or fewer, look, I'm there. I understand it. You know, in, out, get it. I was in the supermarket a couple of weeks ago, and there basically was about 2 tills open. It was a Sunday morning, that first wave of people that have got all their shopping. And it was absolute bedlam. They just wouldn't open like tills up. I just didn't understand it. It's like pushing everyone into this kind of self-service queue. It's like, oh, that's annoying enough. In the same morning, I went to 2 big retailers, you know, big high street stores here, Matalan and M&S. both of them were really adamant that I was going to put what I was buying through the self-service. I hadn't really noticed this before in a clothes shop. I just wanted to pay by till. I don't want to... Listen, again, I might sound old-fashioned, and maybe people listening to this go, oh, my God, Lee, like, get over it. But I'm standing there. I'm having to take the tags out of the clothes and, like, fold the clothes up and put them in the... No! Why am I doing
that? My job!
This is absolutely disgraceful. So, in the end, M&S just let me... They opened the till up and they did it for me. Fine. Matt Lambert just insistent that yeah. I couldn't... But and I didn't want to do that thing where I just kind of leave that. I'm just going to walk out. I was just like, no, don't do that. Just like, take your breath. Left my wife to deal with it because I was like, so she's standing there folding. I wasn't buying clothes, like it was for my daughter. And like, she's folding all these clothes and putting them in a bag. And it's like, I'm like, why? And then
I know.
And then she left something behind. We got home. I was like, where's this? It was like a storage container thing for the fridge. I was like, where's the storage? She's like, oh, I didn't pack it. So if we had like someone just doing this for us, folding the clothes is a very, very small part of like the shopping experience. Why are we letting this all get eroded? And I was kind of came away and there was
money.
An elderly gentleman that was trying to battle this. And I just thought, you know, you go to a shop and that might be that elderly gentleman's, you know, kind of interaction with someone for the day. Yeah. And now that's getting stripped away and he's just got a scanner thing with a gun and, you know, like pack his own shopping away. I mean, and Bree, sorry, George, that was a real moan at the
not end. At all. But I just also, I mean, it's not great for us. It's just frustrating as heck. But I just feel so sorry for the people who do work there. I mean, the ones that have obviously lost their jobs through this, but the ones, what are they just a glorified stander around just to double check that everybody's over 25 to buy booze? I mean, what a job.
100%. This is not me attacking staff, by the way. This is me attacking
of
companies that are kind of thrusting this upon us in a kind of real creep way. And it's just slowly driving me mad. So I've decided, this is, makes me sound like grumpy old man material, but
no,
unless it's food and it's fewer than 10 items, I ain't packing my own bags. Like someone is opening the till for me. I'm making a stand, Georgie. I'm making a stand. Who's going to make a stand on this? I'm fed up of it. And, you know, I say you might be listening to this guy and there's bigger battles to win. But I tell you, once I get
no, to Lee,
that's it.
Choose your hill to die on. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions, team, anything you'd like them to look into, anything more petty that you want to fight your corner?
Lee? The pettier, the better. Yeah. Edison at thisismoney.co.uk. You can X us at thisismoney and you can also comment in the article which this podcast will live.
Lovely. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.